Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm really excited to be here with all of you today. We have Thanksgiving behind us, which, because I do such a big event, I am quite relieved that that is over now, but I want to share some of that with you in a little bit. But I want to also tell you that my guest today will be Marion Nessel, and I'm thrilled to have her on to talk about her new book, The Unsavory Truth, and I'll tell you more about Marion in just a little bit. But first, I want to talk about some things going on in and around the news. I'm sure many of you saw the article or the report that came out this weekend, the scientific report on climate change and how devastating climate change will be to our planet and to America in regards to the financial damage it will wreak on our economy. And it's just very interesting that this is coming out at the same time that Trump is tweeting so much for climate change. You know, he's a non-believer, and he is doing everything he can to reverse all of the safety nets that we had put in to try to counteract climate change happening. And so it's a really great article. If you haven't seen it, I recommend you check it out. It came out in the New York Times on the 25th. Really great article. It's the most comprehensive report to date on climate change. And it's really, really kind of scary, especially since we have an administration that ignores it. So it's certainly a problem. So I hope you all had a lovely Thanksgiving on a happier note. I know I did, and we fed about 700 people in Rufus King Park last Tuesday and made enough food for another 400 people. That food was taken to different local shelters, and it was just a wonderful coming together. I had 138 volunteers that came through the IE Green Homestead over the weekend and cooked up a storm. I personally cooked 84 turkeys in my ovens over the weekend. And, you know, for people that eat turkey, they'd come in and go, oh, it smells great here. But for me, not eating turkey for over 40 years, it was not, it's not the most pleasant thing. But nevertheless, I do cook it for this one time a year holiday and made lots of people very happy. So that was really, really a nice thing. I want to share with you my recipe from Thanksgiving. You know, every Thanksgiving I make a roasted stuffed pumpkin, which is the recipe I shared, not last week since we didn't have a show last week, but the week before. But I want to share with you the stuffed pumpkin soup recipe that I make with the leftover pumpkin from the pumpkin, from the stuffed pumpkin that we served. So once you serve the stuffed pumpkin, you serve the stew that's inside of it. A little bit of the pulp is taken when you're serving the stew, but most of the pulp remains behind as the bowl from the vegetable stew that we just served. So what I do is I scoop out that pulp, which is really, really soft and delicious from having baked with the stew inside of it, so it's very flavorful. I take that, and it's actually more than I actually can use at one time, so I froze half of it. And I used 1 quart of the leftover pulp into a stock pot with 10 cups of water, 4 tablespoons of minced ginger, 3 teaspoons of salt, 1 can of coconut milk, 3 tablespoons of maple syrup, 1 teaspoon of cinnamon, and 1 tablespoon of cardamom. And I put that all into the stock pot, and I brought it to a boil, and I simmered it for about 10 minutes. I pureed it with an immersion blender until it's all smooth. I first did that just with the pumpkin and the water. And then I added the spices and the maple syrup and the coconut milk, and I blended it again and returned it to the stove and simmered it. And that's really it. It was so easy. Of course, you can add some salt, adjust it for your own taste. And then this time, I actually wanted to have it a little chunky. I had some of the stew left over, so I pureed the soup and added some of the pumpkin stew in, so it was actually more of a chunky pumpkin stew, which I had never done before, and it was really, really delicious. So it's a great thing to do with your leftover stuffed pumpkin. If you don't have leftover stuffed pumpkin, of course, you can just roast a pumpkin. I have recipes for that on my website as well. And I apologize for my voice, as you can hear. I lost my voice a lot this weekend after so much celebration. But anyway, I am here and happy to be talking to all of you. So I would like to introduce to all of you my guest. Marion Nessel is a Paulette Goddard Professor and Professor Emeritus at NYU in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, which she chaired from 1988 to 2003, and where she recently retired from teaching after 30 years. She earned a PhD in molecular biology and a master's in public health nutrition from the University of California, Berkeley. From 1986 to 88, she was a senior nutrition policy advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services and editor of the Surgeon General Report on Nutrition and Health. Her research examines scientific and socioeconomic influences on food choice, obesity, and food safety, emphasizing the role of food marketing. She's authored many books, including the James Beard Award-winning book, Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. And that was when that book came out, that was the first time Marion was on my show. She has since written also Safe Food, The Politics of Food Safety, What to Eat, and Soda Politics, which highlighted Coca-Cola's false messaging about sugars linked to health. Her latest book, which I am so happy to have her on to talk about today, is called Unsavory Truth, and that explores the conflicts of interest behind corporate funding of food studies and how that influences the foods we eat. She currently writes the Food Matters column for the San Francisco Chronicle. She blogs almost daily at her website, foodpolitics.com, and tweets at Marion Nessel. In 2011, the University of California School of Public Health at Berkeley named her as public health hero. Time magazine included her Twitter among its top most influential 140 and its top 10 in health and science. Writing for Forbes, Michael Pollan ranked her as the number 2 most powerful foodie in America after Michelle Obama. And Mark Bittman ranked her number 1 of his list of foodies to be thankful for. And so I'm really thankful to have her on my show today. Marion, you with me?
Yes, I am, but I wish you would speak a little bit louder.
Okay, thank you for telling me. I will do my best. As you can hear, I've lost a lot of my voice.
Oh, I'm so sorry, but I'm having trouble hearing you.
Okay, no problem. So in your latest book, in Unsavory Truth, you highlight corporations' influence on how we think about nutrition. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. The new book is about how food companies fund nutrition research and the effects of that funding on the research and on nutrition practice as well. And I think there are, you know, in doing the research for the book, I think there were 3 things that came up that really surprised me. One was that industry-funded research almost invariably comes out with results that favor the sponsor's interest. And there's tons of research that shows that. And the reasons for that are complicated, but it looks like people who take industry funding don't get the influence consciously. The influence slips below the radar of their critical thinking. They don't realize their influence. They didn't intend to be influenced. They certainly didn't intend to appear sold out. And they generally deny that the funding had any influence on the way they designed or conducted their studies. And then the third is that most of the bias that comes out in the industry-funded research comes out in the way the research question is designed, so that there's a big difference. I get letters all the time, for example, from people who, trade associations who write me and say, we're looking for research proposals to demonstrate the benefit of our product. That's a very different question than saying we're looking for research proposals to find out what's happening, if you see the difference.
Yeah, we always talk about open-ended questions. I was in for my annual physical recently, and the nurse came into the room and said, "Have you had your flu shot yet?" And I was like, that's not an open-ended question. That's assuming I'm supposed to have a flu shot. And it really annoyed me, and I, you know, talked to the doctor about it after because, you know, and she told me, you know, ProHealth asked them to word it that way just so that they can sell more flu shots, you know, so that people think that's what they're supposed to do. So how you word things is so important. So
exactly.
And most food studies are paid for by corporations. Why is it that the government...
most is not, it's too strong. There's a percentage of nutrition research that's paid for by food companies, but it's not a large percentage.
It's not.
No, I mean, it's hard to know exactly what proportion is. The one study that I've been able to find that examined that question looked at studies in five leading nutrition journals over a period of a year, looked to see who had funded them, and came out with about 15% as funded by food companies, and of that 15%, the vast majority came out with results that favored the sponsor's interest.
I thought it was actually more than that. I'm surprised. So
it may be in some journals,
but
that's what they found, and my impression is that that's probably about right.
Mm-hmm. And how does the corporation's responsibility to increase shareholder value affect the false advertising?
Well, food companies are not social service agencies. They're not public health agencies, and they can't be expected to be either social service or public health agencies. They're corporations with stockholders to please. And these days, the way our investment system works is that stockholders expect immediate higher returns on investment, and that's the corporation's first responsibility. So food corporations are in a terrible situation in the United States because our food production system provides us with 4,000 calories a day per person, per capita in the United States. Men, women, little tiny babies, everybody has available to us 4,000 calories a day, when for the population as a whole, we probably only need about 2,000 on average
right.
for the entire population. That means there's twice as much food available as the population needs. This makes food companies really competitive. To sell food in an environment in which there's twice as much food available as anybody needs is hard work. And food companies not only have to sell food in that kind of competitive environment, but they have to grow their profits every 90 days. Or Wall Street gets extremely upset and their stockholders get cross and very bad things happen to them. So they have to look for ways to sell food
right.
way beyond just advertising or
uh-huh.
standard marketing techniques. And the ways they do that are, first of all, they fund research that will give them the kind of results that they need to be able to make health claims on food products.
Right. So if you're looking for accurate information about the health benefits of a particular food, where do you recommend people go?
Well, to me, of course. I don't know how to answer that question. I mean, I write books about these kinds of issues that where I summarize the results of my understanding of the research. But, you know, I have other people that I recommend. I think government sources are not a bad place to begin. Major medical sources are not a bad place to begin. You want to look for sources that are as independent as possible and that are not dependent on getting funding from one source or another. Those are hard to come by. But I tell people the most important thing to do is to use common sense. If nutrition research appears to be different than anything you've ever known, or be too good to be true, or be absolute. You must do this, you must eat this, this is a miracle product, it's a breakthrough, everything you thought you knew about nutrition is wrong. Those are all signs that marketing is at work.
Right.
That's not the way, because that's not the way science works.
And what about all these superfood claims that are coming out, whether it's chia seeds or quinoa or pomegranate seeds?
About marketing. There's no such thing as a superfood. All fruits and vegetables, grains, all plant foods have benefits. They have fiber, they have vitamins and minerals, they have antioxidants, they have things that are good for us. And so to market one fruit as better than any other fruit makes no sense. To market one grain as better than any other grain makes no sense. The way that we evolved and the basic tenet of a healthy diet is to eat a variety of relatively unprocessed foods. You want to mix and match them. So to say that blueberries are better than kiwi fruit or pomegranates are better than pears or apples or anything else, that's about marketing. That's market share. Those are all great foods. I think it's terrific that people want to eat them, but they're not superfoods. They're not going to cure everything that ails you.
Right. Now you say one of the places you recommend going is the federal government, but isn't a lot of the federal government agencies infiltrated by corporate interest? You know, you hear about the revolving doors and that kind of thing.
There are places in the federal government that produce very, very good and reliable information. The Department of Agriculture's Economic Research Service and Agricultural Research Service do very, very good work. And I think that's probably why the Department of Agriculture is trying to move them out of Washington. Let's see what we can do to destroy these places that give people accurate information.
And what is, you talk about the Global Energy Balance Network in your book. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. That was a group that was founded by university researchers in 2014-2015. And when they announced that they were forming this new organization whose purpose was to demonstrate that physical activity is more important than what you eat or drink in your body weight, that it doesn't matter what you eat and drink, what really matters is physical activity. When they announced this, they neglected to mention that their group was funded by Coca-Cola. Oh. And so this caused an absolute scandal. The New York Times wrote a big front page article about it. And that caused a lot of changes in the way that Coca-Cola funds research. And it had a lot of things that followed. One university gave back $1 million grant to Coca-Cola, and you know, people lost their jobs. I don't know. It was a big mess.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about it in one of the chapters in the book. And it was, I thought, a perfect example of an industry-funded research that came out with exactly the kind of research that particular industry wanted. Coca-Cola was funding research for very specific purposes, to show that sugar and sugar-sweetened beverages had no effect on health. They didn't increase the risk for obesity. They didn't increase the risk for type 2 diabetes. They were perfectly okay to eat. A second line of research was to discredit any research to the contrary. So the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, for example, which is the main source of epidemiological information about that links sugar-sweetened beverages to poor health outcomes, the Coca-Cola-funded research argued that survey was so poorly designed and so poorly conducted that you didn't have to pay attention to it. And then the third line of research that Coca-Cola funded was to demonstrate that physical activity was more important than what you ate. And all you had to do was be a little bit more active. You know, unfortunately, there's loads and loads and loads of research that argues against all three of those lines of research. And so this was very embarrassing for Coca-Cola. And as a result of the disclosures in the Times, Coca-Cola has changed the way it funds research, is funding different kinds of research now, and withdrew a lot of its funding from health organizations that it never should have been funding in the first place.
yeah, it seems like, you know, a lot of the corporations kind of decide what the outcome is that they want, and then they design the research to fulfill that outcome.
Well, it's much more complicated than that.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's that simple. For one thing, they hire independent investigators to do the research. The company itself is not doing the research. Although, in the investigation of the Global Energy Balance Network, it was very clear that the company was very involved in working with the investigators. And there certainly are examples, and I give them in my book, of companies that are working very closely with the investigators to design it. But mostly you see in the disclosure statements in papers that the company had the funder had nothing to do with the design, conduct, or interpretation of the research or presentation of the research. It's hard to know how accurate that is. I mean, one recent example that came out after my book went to press had to do with the role of the alcohol industry in funding a very, very large clinical trial at the National Institutes of Health. Here's where your government concern comes in. So that the five alcohol companies gave $67 million to the National Institutes of Health to do a study on basically, the benefits of one drink of alcohol a day for reducing heart disease risk. And the study trial, which went underway, another New York Times reporter wrote a story about how the alcohol industry was funding this trial and said that the money was going to the NIH Foundation so that it would be independent of what the industry wanted. And the reporter got a tip from somebody at NIH saying, the National Institute of Alcohol is deeply involved in working with the alcohol industry to make sure that this study doesn't show any harm from alcohol and only shows a benefit for heart disease risk. And once again, they were able to get emails through Freedom of Information Act that demonstrated very close collusion between the NIH and alcohol industry people to make sure, to essentially promise the alcohol industry that the study would come out just the way the industry wanted. So this happens. I don't think it always happens, but it certainly happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you write about the Meat and the Dairy Association as well conducting research kind of similar. I mean, the World Health Organization lists meat as a possible carcinogen and processed meats as a carcinogen, and yet our government still recommends eating, you know, lean meat or low-fat dairy. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe even
the
Chekhov-funded research?
Yeah, that's a very old story. The influence of the meat industry on dietary recommendations is something that I wrote about in my book, Food Politics, in 2002. I mean, that story goes back a long way. The influence of, you know, and the influence of the meat and dairy industries on dietary recommendations goes back 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
They've been involved in that for a long time. The dairy industry funds an enormous amount of research. You know, people are not consuming as much dairy products as they used to. They're certainly not drinking milk. They may be eating more cheese and more yogurt, but they're not drinking nearly as much milk. And the dairy industry has been fighting back for years by funding research to demonstrate the benefits of dairy foods. Independent research may sometimes shows benefits, sometimes doesn't. And the research is so mixed that I just think dairy foods are a food like any other. If you like them and want to eat them, fine. If you don't, that's okay too. The meat industry now has a major problem on its hands, which is that the World Health Organization has viewed it as a potential carcinogen. That's a problem. So it is also very interested in demonstrating that meat is healthy. And for years and years, the meat industry talked about how it's a great meat is a great source of vitamins and minerals and other kinds of really, you know, iron and things that you need. But the kind of research funding that these industries do is designed to promote sales of their products or to protect the industry against charges of harm. And it's pretty easy if you see, you know, when I see a study that extols the benefits of dairy products, just and I look at the title, I can tell from the title that it was funded by the dairy industry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this stuff is really pretty obvious.
Yes, it, you know, for the average consumer, though, they can't. And that's why it's so confusing, because there's so many, you know, it seems like every day or at least, you know, a couple times a week, there's things in the newspaper touting one food or saying one is not good. And it's
These studies are so much fun. They're just so much fun to read about. I mean, my current favorite... and I did a blog post at foodpolitics.com this morning about it because I love it so much. It's a study that demonstrates that if you drink beer, that mice who drink beer have fewer signs of cognitive dysfunction than do mice that don't drink beer. And so the implications are that if you drink beer, you won't get Alzheimer's disease. And if you read the paper, that implication is very clear. So the study was done by Japanese investigators, and guess which beer company funded it? You know, it was funded by the Kirin Beer Company. These things, you look at the titles, and my first question when I see the title of a study like that is, who paid for this? And I'm often right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, your book doesn't really go into GMOs very much.
No, I deliberately excluded GMOs from this particular book because so much has been written about the influence of the agricultural biotechnology industry on the outcome of research that I just didn't think any more on it was needed. And also, the book would have been way too long. I had word limits on this book. So I didn't do anything on production agriculture. I didn't do GMOs. I didn't do organics, although it's very clear that the organic industry funds a lot of studies to prove that organics are better than any other kind. I actually think they are, and I wish the organics industry wouldn't fund that research, but there you go. Mm-hmm. And I also didn't talk about alcohol. I didn't talk about artificial sweeteners. I talked about food products, basically.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I guess it's a safe assumption for people that, you know, what you're stating about who funds it is the same when you're looking at any GMO research.
Oh, absolutely. And there's been lots and lots written about that. Quite a lot. The there hasn't been much. One of the reasons for doing this book was there hasn't been much written about the influence of food industry funding on research on nutrition and health. I used as sort of the model system for studying this the influence of the pharmaceutical industry on physicians' prescription practices and opinions on advisory committee. And there's about 60 years of research on the influence of the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, it just goes back an enormous way. There are libraries full of books. There are literally thousands of articles talking about how the drug industry influences physicians' practices and opinions. But there's almost nothing on food. I was only able to find 11 studies looking at the influence of food industry funding on the outcome of research on nutrition and health. I mean, that's just a handful. And half of those were about sugar-sweetened beverages. So this is a field in its infancy. One of the reasons why I wrote this book was to bring attention to the issue. I think much more attention needs to be paid for it. Needs to be paid to food industry funding, because the influence looks like it works just the way it looks in the drug industry funding. There's not much difference. The drug industry funding story shows that industry-funded studies come out the way the funder wants them to, that the influence is unrecognized, unintentional, unnoticed, it's unconscious for the most part, the bias mostly occurs at the level of the research question, how the question is asked, that larger amounts of funding have a bigger influence than smaller amounts, but even something as minimal as a pen and a pad of paper with a drug logo on it is sufficient to get physicians to change their prescription practices to favor that drug, and so forth and so on. I mean, there's just so much evidence on it that it's, from the standpoint of drugs, they don't even think it should be discussed anymore. It just needs to be dealt with.
Well, you know, in your book, you talk about, you know, they changed the laws to deal with it. And yet, just recently, I'm sure you read about the chief medical officer at Memorial Sloan Kettering that was responsible for all these research papers and these studies and was even
prescribing.
And neglected
to mention them.
What's that?
And neglected to mention his financial connections to to 20 or 30 drug companies is kind of an amazing story.
It was.
Again, revealed in the New York Times.
It was. And, you know, and that he got away with it for so long. And it actually said that he, you know, prescribed things to people that they probably didn't even need just to, you know, make those prescriptions.
Well, from a drug industry standpoint, remember, drug companies are not social service agencies. They're businesses. And their purpose is to sell their brand name drugs, which often are at a higher price and may even be less effective than generics.
Now, if a company funds a research project and the results are unfavorable, do they own the research? Can they not choose to not show that project? You know,
that's been shown over and over again for drug industry funding. For food industry funding, I was unable to find any examples of food companies not allowing the researchers to publish. That doesn't mean they don't exist. It just means that I couldn't find any.
Right,
but there are plenty of examples.
Not publishing them.
Yeah, or not publishing. I mean, there is a publication bias that's been demonstrated where journals don't like to publish negative studies as much as they like to publish positive studies. So there's a bias against that. But you know, what I mostly was able to find was that, you know, and I did this casual collection from March 1915 to March 1916. I posted on my blog every time I had 5 industry-funded studies with results favorable to the sponsor. I put them up on my blog, 5 at a time. At the end of a year, And during that year, I begged readers to send me examples of industry, of food industry funded studies that came out with results counter to the funders' interest. And at the end of the year, I had 12. I had 168 studies posted, and 156 of them came out with results favorable to the sponsors' interest. Now, this was not a systematic study. It was a casual collection. It was just what I ran across whenever I ran across something. But that's the only scientific conclusion I could make from this was that it's just easier to find industry-funded studies that come out with results favorable to the sponsor than it is to find those that don't. And the reason for that is the bias against negative studies, and also if a food industry funds a study and comes out with a negative result, they're very unlikely to fund that investigator again. Why would they pay for studies that are not in their best interest?
Right. They wouldn't. We're going to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I actually would love you to explain the difference between food science research and nutrition research, which you talk about in your book. So everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Marion Nestle about her book, Unsavory Truth, and we'll be right back.
Ladies and gentlemen of America, we extend a special invitation to you to join AJC Radio and our programming every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. Eastern. We will be addressing issues that definitely shape a nation and affect America's future. We will also be dealing with members of Congress, shining the spotlight on our initiative called Spotlight on Capitol Hill. You don't want to miss it, folks. Every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time, AJC Radio makes a difference across the nation. We'll see you then.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm talking with Marion Nestle, author of Unsavory Truth and nutrition expert. Marion, in your book, you talk about food science research and nutrition research and how they're different. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. Food science is a field that grew up as an offshoot of the food industry. The food industry in the early 20th century needed to develop new products. They were they needed to be safer. They needed all kinds of things that would enable them to sell products better. And food science grew up as an academic university-based field that supported the food industry. The purpose of food science is basically to make better food products. The department that I know best is at Cornell. They have a contest every year for students to design the best food product that will sell and make a lot of money. None of this was about health. This is all about commerce. So food science is, in a sense, an offshoot of the food industry. It is the food industry. That's what it's about. Nutrition science is something quite different. It grew out of the discovery of vitamins in the early part of the 20th century and was always concerned with health. And the kind of diets that you should eat in order to stay healthiest. And so if a food company sponsors a food science project, well, of course it does. That's what food science does. It works for the food industry. If the food industry sponsors a nutrition project, there's a conflict of interest because the health issues that are involved may not favor the particular product of the funder, you know, Coca-Cola being the best example of that. I don't really like picking on Coca-Cola, but it sure makes it easy. And also because Coca-Cola got caught with all the different emails that have come out about Coca-Cola's relationships with researchers. We know much more about how Coca-Cola funding works than any other company.
Well, in the book, you also talk about, you know, the research on candy and how, you know, they set out to show how eating candy doesn't contribute to overweight or obesity.
Oh, yeah. This is the work of a reporter for the Associated Press, Candace Choi, who wrote a series of articles about these studies published in perfectly respectable journals that kids who eat candy have healthier diets and are healthier than kids who don't eat candy. And the same thing is true for adults. And those are, again, the titles of those studies, again, trigger the question, who paid for this? The National Confectioners Association. And Candace Choi wrote about that very effectively, I thought.
How can they get away with, like, even publicizing that?
Who's the they? You mean the Confectioners Association? That's why they paid for the studies. Kids who eat candy are healthier than kids who don't. If you're a candy maker, don't you want that kind of result? The confectionery industry is extremely upset that people don't eat enough candy.
Right, right. And if you're a candy lover, you want to see that kind of article, to support why you eat candy.
Yeah, I mean, it's candy is candy. And, you know, I've got a chapter where I talk about sugar candy and chocolate. And the chocolate story is an interesting one because the Mars company spent a fortune, hundreds of millions of dollars, to do research to demonstrate that chocolate is a health food. When I give talks and talk about this kind of thing, I ask for, raise your hand if you think that dark chocolate is a health food. And 3/4 of the audience raises hands. The word is out that if you eat dark, bitter chocolate, you're getting something that's really good for you. Sorry about that. That was research that Mars paid for. And Mars went to an enormous effort to demonstrate that dark chocolate has flavanols, an antioxidant, and therefore was healthy. Mars didn't mention in those studies that the flavanols were destroyed in cocoa processing and that there was so little left that you would have to eat pounds of chocolate a day in order to get any benefit from them. And in fact, that situation was so extreme that Mars stopped. Mars no longer markets chocolate as healthy. It now makes flavanol supplements that it says are healthy and is doing a lot of studies with flavanol supplements to try to demonstrate that they reduce the risk for heart disease or whatever. Well, it's one thing to take a supplement, and it's another thing to think that chocolate will do that.
Mm-hmm. So you just debunked the dark chocolate thing. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that are upset about that. What about the red wine?
I'm sure they're very upset. Personally, I don't like dark chocolate. I find it much too bitter, but I know there are people who like it.
Uh-huh. And what about red wine? Is it the same?
Well, it's the same thing as true of red wine. Again, I didn't talk about alcohol in this book, but the alcohol industry has gone to a lot of trouble to try to demonstrate that the antioxidants in red wine are good for you. We have a big alcohol problem in this country, and for any alcohol industry to be trying to promote alcohol as a health food seems to me to be not a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we have a food movement, you know, obviously that's growing in this country, thank goodness, but there's inherent issues that are a part of it, like struggling with food justice, access to healthy food, and space for people to grow their own food. Can you talk about how food marketing plays into these issues?
Well, food marketing, again, I mean, I'll say it again. Food companies are not social service agencies. They make products that we love, but their objective is to sell more food at the highest price they can get away with. And one of the things that food companies do is to sell foods at low prices that everybody can afford, and they make a tiny profit on it, but they make their profits through volume. And in my book, Soda Politics, which is the book I wrote before this one, I talk a lot about how the soda industry markets in inner-city areas to low-income people, to people in developing countries, and so forth, to try to get poor people to buy these products thinking that they're, if not good for them, then at least that there's something that will make them feel good or that are delicious or they're going to like or it's going to make them popular or sexy or, the marketing of sugar-sweetened beverages through music figures of color or through sports figures of color. That's deliberate marketing to low-income populations in order to expand sales. That's what it's about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's really unfortunate because it's so cheap, it's cheaper than so many other drinks. And that's why they buy it. I mean, I can't believe a 2-liter bottle is like 79 cents. It's less than a small bottle of water.
Well, that's what they can do. And part of that is the marketing that goes into it, billions of dollars a year in marketing of one kind or another. And I always like pointing out that marketing expenses are business expenses that can be deducted from corporate taxes. So this is a way in which the population, taxpayers, subsidize food corporations because they're subsidizing their marketing. And we won't even get into, with the soda industry, the various ways in which municipal water supplies, which are subsidized by taxpayers, are used by soda companies to make their products. So,
yeah. Yeah, we've all heard the story of Nestle, taking water from California and all that. So what about the Chekhov-funded research that you talk about in your book? Can you explain how that works, both with the meat and dairy associations?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that? I couldn't hear it.
Sure. The Chekhov-funded research, how those programs work, how the meat and dairy associations work with our government in those.
Oh, it's not only the meat and dairy industry. It's loads of trade associations for various kinds of healthy foods as well. These are generic marketing programs, and there are two different kinds of them. One are called checkoffs, and the checkoffs refer to the fact that the producers of these foods pay a tax into a common pooled fund for however much they sell. That's the checkoff. And then though that money is pooled into a common fund used for research and promotion. The best one that's known is the Got Milk campaign for the National Milk Producers. And those are the best known ones. But there are checkoffs for pork and for beef and for, different kinds of meat products. There are a couple of them for dairy products. And then there's a different kind of marketing program that the Department of Agriculture also runs for trade associations for various fruits and vegetables, nuts, and so forth. And these enable these trade associations to use that money to market their products. The government isn't supposed to, there's not supposed to be any taxpayer money going into these programs, but they're administered by the Department of Agriculture. Weird. Mm.
So does some of our tax money go into it?
It's not supposed to.
Uh-huh. Okay, let's talk about greenwashing. How does some of these large corporations and their partnerships with nonprofit sector, help them in greenwashing their products?
Well, Coca-Cola is the best example of this because we know who Coca-Cola funds. And the reason that we know who Coca-Cola funds is because after the revelations about the Global Energy Balance Network, Coca-Cola went transparent. And if you Google Coca-Cola transparency, you'll go immediately to Coca-Cola's website where it lists every community organization and every individual that it funds. through its various practices. And and a lot of these are community groups of color. A lot of them are exercise groups. A lot of them are children's playground kind of groups. And the groups that take this money, what a coincidence. They tend not to be very critical of Coca-Cola or critical of sugar-sweetened beverages. And there have been many examples, and I talked about them mostly in my book, Soda Politics, where there were groups that were involved in campaigns to try to get people to drink fewer sugar-sweetened beverages, and then when Coca-Cola started funding them, they dropped those campaigns.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, because, you know, I think there was a lot of talk about that in, whose book was that? Andy, the connection between, you know, a lot of these big food corporations donating food to food banks and how that also affects, you know, the people in food banks not wanting to criticize or talk out against any of these junk food companies because they get
so
much.
If you're a food company and you make a donation, your donation will buy silence on the subject. If, you know, particularly if you're a soda company where there's so much evidence linking large consumption of sugary beverages to poor health. You know, if you're a soda company, you want to silence that kind of criticism. And gifts work that way.
Sure.
We're very susceptible to gifts.
I'm sorry. What about the current research that just came out about all the pesticides in cereals? Who funded that, and is that an accurate research project?
Well, that research came out of the Environmental Working Group?
Yes,
that's an independently funded non-governmental organization. I don't know who pays for them.
Uh-huh.
I don't know who their funders are offhand. But they're a group that's very interested in keeping pesticides out of the environment. That's what they do. And they're producing information that we wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah, I think they are a really good group. And what else? What other research would you like to share with us from your book that I have not brought up?
Well, I think we've covered a great deal of it. I also talk in the book about industry funding of nutrition professional organizations. Like the Academy for Nutrition and Dietetics, the Association for the American Association for Nutrition, and so forth. Some of these organizations take money from food companies, and I demonstrate in the book how this affects their statements about matters having to do with the food industry. This funding tends to buy silence on food issues, like the ones we've already talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Or in some cases, the organizations come out in favor of positions that you wouldn't expect them to. For example, the American Society for Nutrition, which I'm a member of, filed comments on when the FDA was looking for comments on changing the food label and wanted to put added sugars on the food label. The American Society for Nutrition came out with a position against that. And I thought that was kind of amazing because that was a public health measure that had widespread public support, and eventually the FDA did it anyway. But why would a nutrition organization come out opposed to that? Well, one reason is that they get money from food companies, and not even all that much. Remember, even small gifts have an effect.
Right. That was really interesting when you talked about that. You know, like you would think a pen or a pad would not affect someone's, outcome.
where, you know, of course, a free trip or a meal, you know, that certainly would. But it was surprising to see that even those small gifts had an effect. You know, when you talk about the, not necessarily the silence, but, you know, for me, one of the biggest ones is how our, you know, our food nutrition guidelines does not really address meat consumption and dairy consumption as something to really minimize. I think you actually talk about that they're not allowed to say that, you know, that there's so much pressure from the meat and dairy associations that, you know, the best they can do is say, you know, buy lean meat or use low-fat dairy.
Yeah, they use euphemisms. I always liked the food guide pyramid because it visually stated that meat and dairy should be consumed in small amounts relative to plant foods. I thought that was good. But that was so opposed. I mean, everybody just couldn't wait to get rid of it. It was the pyramid was criticized by many, many people. We now have a plate in which half the plate is fruits and vegetables, and then there's a section for protein, which is a chef's term, it's not a nutritionist's term, and then grains. And so meat doesn't even appear on the plate, at least by name, although you assume that it's in the protein category. I don't know. I don't think the plate makes a whole lot of sense.
Although visually, I think people understand it, and that's, you know, that's its purpose.
Well, I'm not sure.
But anyway, we are just about out of time. I want to thank you so much, Marion, for joining me. Your book is great. I recommend everybody get the book, Unsavory Truth. And Marion, can you just share your website one more time with my listeners so that they can find
you? Yeah, I blog every day and put up my papers and information about the books and all that kind of thing at foodpolitics.com.
Wonderful. So thank you for joining us, and thank you, everyone, for listening. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.